Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Our guest today is Dr. Nirav Shah, the New York State Commissioner of Health, a Buffalo native. Dr. Shah is board certified in internal medicine and is a graduate of Harvard College and Yale School of Medicine. You don't get better than that. Commissioner Shah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I'm sitting here hearing all of the news on healthcare. But before we get into that, tell us just a little bit about your own upbringing, because most of our people still don't know you.
Sure. I was born and raised in Buffalo, New York, and I stayed there through high school. It was the perfect upstate, or as we like to call it, Western New York upbringing. I went off to college to Boston, then spent a few years in New Haven, Connecticut, rounded out my training at UCLA, and then ended up in New York City about 10 years ago.
And your specialty?
Internal medicine.
I noticed when you came in, we had a little conversation about what you ate for lunch, and you mentioned that you were a vegetarian. Is this something you would recommend to others?
It's a personal choice. I think that there are many ways to eat healthy. I prefer a vegetarian diet, and it works for me.
How did you come to be health commissioner? Did you know the governor before? Was it a search? How did it happen?
There was a search, and I was actually asked by the governor's folks to help select the next health commissioner. About a week into the process, they suggested that I might want to apply. And one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was speaking with the governor about this position.
Is it more than you counted on?
Absolutely. It's phenomenal. It's an amazing opportunity to get to work with the best people across the country. I've worked in many places, at Harvard, at Yale, most recently at NYU. But the people I work with every day in state government are there for all the right reasons. They work harder than anyone I know, and they do it for all the right reasons.
So you don't look like you could have worked in all those places. You look very young. Maybe it's the vegetarian diet.
That and exercise.
Yeah. How much exercise should everybody do every day, doctor?
Well, you do what you can do. I think that the jury's out on any number of minutes. But if you can try to do at least a half hour of walking per day, and based on your ability, a little more than that, it can only help.
I remember when they were telling us it was 2 days a week, then it was 3 days a week. I've always done an hour every day, but I want a pat on the back for that. I think, you know, if we all exercise, it would be pretty good for us. Yes, or is it such a thing as overdoing it?
Absolutely. I mean, we totally underdo it as a nation. And if we can just do a little more walking, a little more exercise, we can all prevent a lot of the diseases that we're facing today.
Now, Mayor Bloomberg has been out front in terms of diet and what we should have, and putting up the number of calories in the big stores, which I think is terrific, and getting the soda machines out of the schools, as many people know. How important is that in terms of our huge girth of this country?
You know, we are getting bigger as a nation every day, and that problem is going to be one of the biggest public health challenges of the century. Unfortunately, it's about the choices we make every day. And what we do, sometimes we don't realize the choices we're making. When you have calorie information in front of you, it's easy to make the right choice and
sure,
substitute something. Without that information, it's easy to make the wrong choice.
You see 550 calories on a muffin and you say, uh-oh, I can't do that.
Well, have a bite of it and then waste it or give it away.
Depends on what kind of person you are. My wife is Aristotelian in that she believes in everything in moderation, but I'm incapable of moderation, and I think many of us are. That's a question, I think.
It's good you're married to your wife.
So let's talk about the healthcare exchanges. I think to this moment, most people have no idea what they are. And I'd love to know how New York is handling, you know, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare.
Mm-hmm. We're very lucky that the governor in April ordered that the New York State Department of Health create an exchange for the state of New York. This will actually allow 1 million people who've never had insurance before to enter the insurance rolls and have health care. Right now, everyone has health care if you go to the emergency room, but that's not the kind of health care we're talking about. When you actually have insurance, you can get the kind of preventive care, the chronic care for your chronic conditions like diabetes and hypertension to keep you well in the first place. 1 million more people on the healthcare rolls, on the insurance rolls, will mean $5 billion a year from the feds in terms of subsidies, tax subsidies, and supplements, which is a big boon to the economy. Right now, a lot of hospitals provide uncompensated care. That will go down.
I mean, I think people are still confused as to the mechanics. I mean, I'm John Q. Public. Mm-hmm. How do I get to this exchange? What is the exchange? Is it like the stock exchange? Is it on a computer?
No, that's a great
what
question. So the exchange is really a complicated name for an insurance marketplace. There will be a really nice website where consumers can log on and see what meets their needs and sign up for an insurance product. On the other hand, the traditional navigators and people who helped small businesses, for example, buy insurance products will still be in business and helping navigate small businesses into the right products for them.
Okay, so there are a couple of things here. First of all, you can do most of this on your computer. And at what point do you get to see a doctor after you're done with the computer?
Well, this will really start October of 2013. Enrollment will begin then, and it'll really start by 2014. What that means is once you've selected a product and you know what's right for you, you can see a doctor shortly thereafter. You will have an insurance product. It's just like every other insurance. Most of us get it through where we work. This is for a lot of people who are just beyond the Medicaid eligibility, but not quite there in terms of the number of hours they work or they don't get it through work. Those folks will have access to high-quality insurance. And all the small businesses will also be able to go and get rational products. Right now, there's over 1,500 different types of insurance in the state of New York for small businesses to buy from.
Now, what if you don't do this? What happens to you?
Well, there are encouragements to do it. You know, there are subsidies in terms of the rates you pay. And if you don't do it, there are some small penalties as well. The realistic situation is for the vast majority of people who really do want insurance, this will make it affordable for the first time. It'll drop rates of insurance by 60% for the individual who's trying to buy an insurance product today. And for small businesses, the cost will go down by 22%.
Talk to me a little bit, if we can move along here, about the flu. Everybody's giving flu shots. You go into your CVS or your Rite Aid or the rest of it. They're pushing them like crazy. What are their incentives to do this?
Well, it's absolutely important that everyone get their flu shot. We know this year is an earlier flu season and worse than in prior years. Last year was easy. We got away with a relatively mild year. And even in a mild year, we had a pediatric death and over 1,600 hospitalizations for the flu in the state of New York. In the last 4 years, we've had 34 children die from the flu. So to the extent that we understand as a community the importance of getting flu shots, we're trying to make it easy for everyone to get them in any setting. Have you had your flu shot?
Indeed. I always get my flu shot. I'm a scaredy cat.
Good.
And so has my wife, and so have my kids. But it is a problem getting everybody to do it. And then there is some sort of, I don't want to put a bad name on this, but cultish groups who believe that no vaccinations, no shots are a good idea. That's pretty selfish, isn't it?
Well, you know, people have their own strongly held beliefs. And if you look at the data and evidence around flu shots, it's overwhelmingly safe for anyone over 6 months old to get it. And it prevents lying flat on your back for a week if you get the flu. Now, I think the jury is not out. Most people would select a quick flu shot to protect themselves and their family if they were informed with all the data. And I think more and more people are getting to that realization.
Mm-hmm. What about the ancillary business of vaccinations, whooping cough, and things of that kind? That's where I really think it becomes somewhat selfish. You were very nice to say it's a personal choice on people's parts. But if you don't get your kid vaccinated, it could have major effects on the society, yes?
You know, we see unnecessary deaths every year, and it breaks my heart when folks don't get the vaccinations they need to get. I think that as people understand the choices that they're making and what effect it has on their neighbors and their populations and their schools, most people do make the right choice given the facts.
Talk to me about hospitals and infection rates. I'm about to go have a back operation. And I was told by somebody I respect, in fact, was married once to David Axelrod, one of your predecessors, that you have to check out what the hospital infection rates are. And I hadn't even thought about doing that. Can you explain all of that?
You know, we've paid very careful attention to improving rates of hospitals, lowering the rates of infections that you get in a hospital, and just came out with a report 2 weeks ago that's available on our website that describes the state of the state's hospitals.
Interesting.
We have been doing better every year. Rates are going down because we're doing things like publicly reporting the data. So you know what happens when you go to a hospital in terms of infections. That has made hand washing and other simple things become universal practice almost across the board.
If a hospital is known for really special kinds of surgery and do major operations, aren't they more likely to have higher infection rates because they're taking chances that don't go on in other hospitals?
You know, you're right. So what we talk about is risk adjustment. If you have sicker patients to show up in a hospital, they're more likely because their immune systems are weaker to have infections. So we try to adjust for that in reporting out the results and say, when you have Mrs. Jones show up at hospital X versus hospital Y, what's her chances of having an infection? It's a thoughtful approach.
Are doctors who stray from the traditional path, who have different ways of doing things, do they face greater risk from regulation from the Department of Health than others do? Every once in a while, I see somebody who didn't want to put something into some kid's eyes when they were born or something like that, claiming that they've been, you know, sort of unfairly treated. What do you make of that?
You know, we all trained at different times, and our training in medical school is the best predictor of how we practice for the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years of practice sometimes. It's become very hard to keep up with all the medical literature. And so what we're trying to do is not to be in a gotcha state of mind, but into a state of mind of helping doctors practice the latest evidence-based medicine. And we've done a lot working with the medical societies and hospitals to foster that culture of learning. It's hard being a doctor, and it's not about wanting to do the wrong thing. You do it because you want to help people. It's hard to keep up sometimes.
Can you give me an example of one thing in which you try to get the medical community to know what the latest research is about?
Let me give you an example of something that's been in the news lately. You know, healthcare workers getting flu shots.
Right.
Right. We have seen many approaches across this country with some states mandating that every healthcare worker get a flu shot. And in New York State, we have not taken that approach. We've been trying to work with the unions, with hospital management, with the clinical staff to get rates up. And we've had a lot of success. Our rates are somewhere about 50% of healthcare workers get their flu shots that are documented. It may be higher, but we don't have good documentation. Obviously, we need to get that much higher. We need to get that over 90%. That'll protect their patients. How do you get there? You can certainly mandate it and force people to do things like that. But if you really want to change culture, if you really want to not make this an us versus them conversation, you need to change their minds. You need to change their approach and understand this is about patient-centered care. I need to protect my patients. I'm going to get a flu shot or I'm going to wear a mask. And that's been an approach that we've used over and over again with much success. It changes us from being a regulator and an enforcer to being a partner and collaborator working through real data in real time to improve things.
It's very interesting. If you walk down the streets in Manhattan, now you will see A on the front of somebody's restaurant. This is an A restaurant. They have a clean kitchen or whatever. Is this a good idea?
You know, gradings are highly subjective. You try to quantify 15 different things into a letter grade. What it does is it focuses the issue around, you know, would you walk into a restaurant with a D grade? Probably not. On the other hand, does it matter if it's an A or a B, and do you understand truly what makes the difference between an A and a B? Probably not. So to some extent, it fosters competition. It forces everyone to try to continually improve. But rankings are an oversimplification in many ways of the more complicated things that underlie any given issue, whether it's restaurant rankings, hospital rankings, doctor rankings, or all of the above.
There's a lot of talk about it, and I'm sorry to do this to you, and I apologize for it, but there's a lot of talk about hydrofracking. And there are many people who are against the fracking who are claiming it has major health implications. Now, I know that there's a series of studies going on about all of this. Can you let us in on any of the results?
Well, this is a work in progress. Back in September, Commissioner Martens of the Department of Environmental Conservation asked that I conduct a public health review of the draft revised supplemental generic environmental impact statement. This is an incredible document that they've produced. And I was asked to engage experts to help review the health aspects of it. This is a work in progress. We've engaged three of the best experts in the country. Dr. Lynn Goldman is the dean of the GW School of Public Health, former EPA administrator, professor at Johns Hopkins in environmental health, on the board of trustees of the Environmental Defense Fund, and two other experts, one from Colorado, Dr. John Adgate, who's chair of the Department of Environmental Health Sciences. Someone who's conducted a health impact assessment in Colorado on this topic, and another professor from UCLA, Dr. Jackson, who has studied it extensively and the effects on communities. So we're taking this very seriously and looking at the health impacts of any such activities and what would need to be done to improve any mitigation that's already in the draft EIS document.
What do you mean mitigations? I'm sorry.
So when you have a well, how far away from water sources does it need to be? What kind of monitoring needs to be done? What kind of sampling needs to be done over time? Any and all of those things that relate to health, whether it's air pollution, noise, stress levels in the community, injuries related to car accidents that may occur, anything related to health, does the draft plan address it? If not, what can be done to address it? And what can be done on an ongoing basis to continue to stay ahead of the science? This is an evidence-based review about the science.
How do we fool with this whole thing? I mean, if we're forcing chemicals, some of which we know, some of which we don't, down into the ground, isn't it just better not to do it until we absolutely know what will happen? And as you just said, it's an evidence-based process, so we don't have the evidence yet.
I'm neither for nor against. I'm just looking at the health aspects of it.
Sure.
And, walking across the street to your station today, there's some risk associated with those crazy trucks driving by.
There certainly is.
And it's about understanding the risk, understanding where there's gaps in the evidence, and making the best policy based on the evidence whenever possible.
We have HIPAA laws. We're supposed to have privacy and when we go to see a doctor and all the rest. But also, there's a new thing, which is that electronic medical records will be, kept on all of us. And that means a lot of people can have access to our health procedures and whatever else we've gone through in life. I wonder if you could talk about both sides of that one.
Sure. Electronic health records are really a boon to medicine. Until now, every other industry has actually embraced computers and electronic records, except for healthcare. In healthcare, what we're learning is there is a lot of waste in the system. Up to a third of all healthcare dollars are spent in redundant testing and missing things that have been done in the past. Electronic health records can do a lot to reduce the waste and improve care. There is always a risk of other folks obtaining your medical records, but with electronic health records, the way they've done it is there's going to be a log. So whereas in the past, anyone could walk up to your medical record, open it up, put it away, and you don't know that it happened, when it's electronic, anytime anyone accesses your medical records for any reason, there's a log. And if you're accessing someone's record and you're not supposed to be, you will lose your job. And that has already happened in many places around the country. So in one respect, it's actually much more secure than the old system of doing things.
Interesting. And if you've had an MRI somewhere and you walk in and the guy says, have you done an MRI? And you say, I don't remember. The doctor will probably be able to see that MRI scan.
With your permission, with your consent, they can actually transmit that MRI from Buffalo to Brooklyn in real time. And in the state of New York, we're creating that whole system so that you can have seamless care wherever you show up.
How are we doing on Lyme disease?
We are actually doing all right. We are in a multi-state consortium with the CDC doing studies on ticks. In Dutchess County, we have over 600 households enrolled in this study and understanding what kind of things you do with your lawn, pesticides applied, et cetera, actually make a difference or not with tick-borne diseases.
Well.
And it's a work in progress. And I think that, all of New York State is affected by Lyme disease and tick-borne diseases. We don't know enough about the long-term effects, and that's why we need to do these kinds of studies.
Well, now that you're doing this administration, do you miss your clinical practice?
I do. I'm hoping to get back to it early next year, maybe a day a week over at Albany Med.
Really? How does that happen, that the commissioner walks in and says to Jim Barber at Albany Med, I'd like to do a day a week here in clinical?
I'd like to volunteer my time. It takes about 2 years for the lawyers to figure out how I can actually do it, and that's why I'm hoping by January I can actually start. But it's about precepting students, and I recently recertified in internal medicine, took a long test, and made sure my skills are up to speed. I became a doctor to help people. It's fun to help people at all levels, whether it's one at a time or a state at a time. And I hope to get back to the one at a time.
How does that recertification thing work anyway? If you're a cardiologist, every so often you have to take an exam, see whether you've been reading and whether you know the new stuff?
Every 10 years, since 1990, if you certified the first time before 1990, you're grandfathered. But after that, every 10 years, you take a really long test and do all these exercises online to make sure you're up to speed with the latest and greatest in medicine.
Do you think there's a relationship between memory, you know, remembering all of that stuff, and being a good doctor?
Absolutely. I mean, we know from studies that have been done that show that people who do well in medical school, not just on the tests, but on other parts, continue to do well and provide high-quality care afterwards.
How are our medical schools doing in New York State?
Our medical schools still continue to provide some of the best education in the country, and New York is the premier destination for training, not just postgraduate, not just medical school, but residency and fellowship as well. Mm. That's at risk with some of the negotiations going on at the federal level, something called, you've heard of the fiscal cliff. There's now a
I've heard of that.
Graduate medical education and IME cliff.
In other words, that they may be two of the casualties of having to save money.
That's right. And that is of serious concern to this administration. We are working to make sure
your administration, maybe not the Obama administration. Right?
I think everyone who wants high-quality health care knows the value that New York's medical schools and graduate programs bring. It's just not front and center when you're having these debates on large dollars and cents.
You went to Harvard and Yale. What's the best medical school in New York State? Oh, brother.
They are all fantastic. I really enjoyed my time.
Yeah.
I almost went to SUNY Buffalo, but it was a little too close to home at the time. And I think that we're very lucky to have a high caliber of state schools, private schools across the board.
Now, Dr. Shah, you are Indian in terms of heritage. Your folks, your grandparents, are they proud of you?
I'd like to think so, yes. I'm going to see them soon in India, and
really?
I look forward to spending some quality time with them.
Does everybody call you on the phone when they have a small problem, a health problem?
I am now the state's doctor. I have so many friends I didn't even know about who ask where I should go, and I say every hospital in the state of New York is fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. And when you are done with this, what would you like to say you have achieved?
I'd like to say we've achieved making healthcare better for New York, making health the focus, not just healthcare, and making the Department of Health, which already is probably one of the best agencies in the state of New York, even stronger for the long term.
Well, it has been a magnificent department, and they have done such great work over the years, and we're all very proud of them. Our guest has been New York State Commissioner of Health, Dr. Nirav Shah, and we hope that you'll come back. We always will welcome you because you're just a bright light, and we appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.